This is the 295th edition of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. A couple of weeks ago, I announced these broadcasts would no longer be repeated on CJLY in Nelson. I'm pleased to say that the station has relented, and I will be carried through next April at least. We found that there actually are people in that lovely town who listen to Uncle Don regularly, thanks to those of you who requested my continuation. This show is dedicated to Muntadir al-Zaidi. Zaidi? Okay. Flinger of shoes at the head of George Wanker Bush. In the Middle East, this is the grossest of insults. We should not overlook what this angry man shouted in Arabic as he threw the first missile. This is your farewell kiss, you dog. This is from the widows, the orphans, and those who were killed in Iraq. The Globe editorialized this man as a disgrace to the journalistic profession, but the vast majority of Iraqi Arabs find him a hero. One thing you can say for sure, Muntadir holds the world record for value added. He turned a $10 pair of leather shoes into a potential $10 million set of artifacts, according to the bid made for them by a Saudi prince. Watch for as many pairs of these authentic shoes to turn up on the market as pieces of the true cross. Muntadir has prompted adoption of an old Canadian custom in Washington. Visitors to the White House will henceforth be kicking off their footgear at the door. About time for them to become civilized. I look forward to seeing scrums with reporters padding around in their stocking feet. They will experience the humiliation known to herds of airport visitors, forced to expose their hosiery to obnoxious paranoids thanks to the actions of a man attempting to set off a shoeborne explosive in an aircraft. His precedent was not as benign as Muntadir's. Muntadir has expressed regret at his impetuous tossing of footwear, prompted perhaps by his jailers, as evidenced by facial bruises. From Saturday's Globe, I pirated the following lines as relate to our Iraqi hero of the day. Here is John Alamang's The Shoe Fits. We know you must apologize and mutter badly scripted lies to save some face and help appease stern men who fear 11 D's. But though they've made you sound contrite, that can't diminish our delight at acts that might have once seemed rude but now deserve our gratitude. It's not just you, we feel the same, the awful, helpless sense of shame that on our watch as humankind the world bent to his empty mind. So when you grabbed your shoes and threw, revenge was ours. At last, he knew, what drives an angry man to grieve these wasted years of make-believe. And now you've earned for your descent a course in anger management. But swift reprisals can't undo the power of a well-tossed shoe. Our Iraqi journalist friend has set a new standard for political protest, one that has already surfaced here. On Saturday, there was a protest at the U.S. consulate in Montreal where demonstrators threw shoes at the building in protest against American war policies. Most interesting. Will it spread? I do hope so. Until we figure where this is going, save your old shoes, as we may have an opportunity to use them productively in the future. An odd phenomenon during times of economic distress is the growth of evangelical churches. I can understand people need companionship and reassurance these days, and churches may drive them together, but I'm perplexed by their embracing the unbelievable as deliverance from concrete problems. These are times when governments can ameliorate financial pain. There's no record of divine intervention on behalf of the economy, except possibly in the case of fattening the profits of tax-exempt churches. Pews are being warmed by those who had little time for religion when occupied with working, shopping, and accumulating debt. Like a prisoner who has gone religious when faced with a parole hearing, those dealing with financial fears may go to preachers who tell them that hardships are the work of a wrathful Lord. Repent your sins and God will find you a job or refinance your mortgage. I just don't buy it. One California televangelist declared, "We need to leverage this moment because every Christian revival in this country's history has come off a period of rampant greed and fear. That's what we're in today, the time of fear and greed." One former employee of Morgan Stanley, newly fired, went to an evangelical church looking for a source of meaning. He said he found God's authority over everything. I feel him walking with me. Funny that he didn't feel that authority when he was raking in the big bucks. As Gordon Gekko said in the movie Wall Street, if you need a friend, get a dog. Most of us have conjured up an imaginary friend when we were young, but maturity should obviate that need. It comes down to a matter of faith, the subject of a book I just finished entitled The End of Faith. The author makes the case that all faith in the unproven and unprovable is misguided, inhibiting the expansion of our learning about the real world. Faith can have an absolute stifling effect on progress and knowledge. Look at the Middle Ages when the Catholic Church directed its attention to finding witches and devils, initiating a reign of terror fostering ignorance and cruelty for centuries. During that time, learning and science advanced in the Arab world, building on knowledge from the Greeks and Romans until the Reformation. Then Islam swept the Middle East, replacing learning with militant faith, brooking no denial. The harshest of these believers have stifled learning in that area ever since, making sure that madrasas do not teach, but force acolytes to memorize an ancient text. Faith in itself is a weird thing. The idea that anyone should believe anything that cannot be proven or disproven is just strange. Perhaps gullibility is an artifact of our evolution from our forebears. I feel that I'm on firm ground criticizing faith. Christopher Hitchens said, "What can be asserted without evidence can also be dismissed without evidence." I accept theories on evolution and the origin of the universe as they are based on observation and experiment. They are falsifiable, meaning that they are open to challenge if new facts are discovered. You cannot say that about any faith, which builds a wall around its beliefs, saying they cannot be challenged even when confronted with contrary evidence. In its attempt to demonstrate its bent upon becoming a kind, gentle, and ecologically friendly corporation, General Motors is retooling. As the showpiece of their new persona, GM has redesigned their iconic Hummer. Whereas the original H1 was a modified military Humvee, the subsequent H2 and H3 models were progressively smaller and more civilian-friendly. General Motors will soon introduce its latest Hummer, the H4, a four-passenger, two-wheel drive hybrid, bearing some of the lines of the original, but much reduced and less aggressive. They're staking GM's future on the public's embracing this new vehicle, although some have misgivings over the modified logo. In an attempt to distance the corporation from any hint of sympathy for Muslim extremists, the H4 logo will not use Arabic numerals, but Roman ones. We shall see how this new Roman numeral HIV goes over with the public. A recurrent theme in the economic news is that some corporations and industries are too big to fail. Assuming that some firms, like major auto companies and banks, are too big to fail, what lessons are we to derive from this? The popular one is that we must rush to their aid with public money and soften policies to keep them alive when they are in difficulties. My take is different. I think that too big to fail indicates that public policy should declare that such entities are too big to survive. No single enterprise should be permitted to gain such a stranglehold over our economy that we cannot survive without it. As far back as the 19th century, there was American antitrust legislation designed to break up conglomerates that ruled entire sectors of the economy. John D. Rockefeller was not allowed to maintain a monopoly of oil, so his Standard Oil was broken into bits that were to compete for the benefit of consumers and the economy. Likewise with railways, coal, and steel. With the advent of Reagan, Thatcher, and our very own Mulroney, government oversight of dominant institutions changed from maintaining competition to promoting the grand benefits to be derived from allowing corporations to merge and swallow one another in the interest of efficiencies, promising better products and lower prices. The results were not as advertised. Auto companies cranked out overpriced, oversized luxury vehicles, and the public was told to like them or walk. Fortunately, Asian companies restored some competition, and the big three are harvesting the fruits of their folly. Banks and other financial institutions were allowed to grow so huge and convoluted that no one knew how to wind them down without a catastrophic collapse. We're all harvesting that crop. And so it has gone from one industry after another. What are we to do? We can nip future crises in firms too big to fail by assuring that every industry is composed of firms, each small enough not to be critical to the economy, yet large enough to compete. Industrials love their level playing fields when it affects their suppliers and customers. Let us take it home to them by assuring they do not merge their way to becoming too big to fail. if we haven't a market of competing companies vying to provide the best products and services to the public at the lowest costs, why do we allow capitalism anyway? One day, when the NDP Liberal Coalition was forming its non-confidence majority, Stephen Harper saw the handwriting on the wall. Facing ouster from his job, he reacted by appointing 25 political hacks to federal pension tribunals and employment insurance boards. Such patronage rewards are common to all parties in power, but not when they have lost the confidence in the House. This is patent abuse of power. Likewise, it is an abuse of power for that government without confidence to appoint 18 senators. Power and patronage are the name of the game, and Harper plays the game like any schoolyard bully. Another piece of conservative work that escaped widespread notice or understanding is the Agreement on Internal Trade, an extension of the TILMA, the Trade and Labor Mobility Agreement between Alberta and British Columbia. Sold to us as a means of lowering barriers to business and workers operating in other provinces, this agreement on internal trade will have some devastating effects on small businesses and workers. Some businesses which benefited from government contracts restricted to local bidders can be overwhelmed by huge nationwide outfits, which may take contracts at a loss just to gain a local foothold. British Columbian companies whose workers are unionized can be underbid by companies from Alberta and beyond employing non-union labor or those supposedly represented by a certain company-loving Christian union. This bit of legislation from Harper, like all of his initiatives, is a gift to his supporters and of no benefit to the rest of us. Time to lighten up and go seasonal. Time for good cheer and goodwill toward all. Here's to the brokers who made a mint by selling dubious securities to pensioners. Here's to millionaire auto executives of the Big Three who made the short-sighted decisions, leading them to Washington and Ottawa, asking the public to fill their Christmas stockings. Here's to the Bush regime and their victims around the world. Here's to legislators everywhere, saving the greedy and foolish while piling up public debt that our children and grandchildren will have to pay. As for me, I'm making my annual list of resolutions, but I do this every year and my wife refuses to keep any of them. We've been groomed to read stock market indexes as indicators of general economic health. This is an aspect of that discredited trickle-down theory holding that increasing fortunes of billionaires was good for the folk at the bottom who do the actual work. Can we take an average seriously when it automatically excludes figures at the bottom of the scale? It's like calculating average incomes of Canadians while excluding those working at McDonald's for less than $10 an hour. This is what the Toronto Stock Exchange is doing. They're dumping from their index 20 stocks that have fallen below $1 a share or missed arbitrary liquidity thresholds. Excluded are the parent of Air Canada, Great Canadian Gaming Corporation, and a bunch of mining and petroleum outfits. It looks like there will be a sole addition to the TSX index, Ritchie Brothers. Here's a company that does its best when its clients do their worst, selling off stranded assets. We cannot expect the revised index to truly reflect a failing economy. Again, we're being gulled by those who we've been told to trust. Dale Cole, the lawyer for Mayor Arar, has made a coherent case before a dozen judges that his client was and is the victim of an international conspiracy. This Canadian citizen could not have been kidnapped in New York and surreptitiously flown to a Syrian torture cell without a concerted effort of Canadian and American officials. Arar's counselor made the case that this conspiracy reached the highest levels of American Justice Department and the FBI, not to mention the RCMP. His lawsuit names former Attorney General John Ashcroft and Federal Bureau of Investigation Robert Mueller as defendants. This whole kidnap operation was covered up with subterfuge and prevarications, including holding a Sunday night hearing and lying about Arar's whereabouts even as he was on the CIA plane. The conspiracy continues as officials cover for each other and hide behind claims of national security. One of the judges said, "So the minute the executive raises the specter of foreign policy, national security, it's the government's position that it's a license to torture anyone? License meaning you can do so without financial consequence? That's your position?" It used to be said that patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel. Now it seems that national security has displaced patriotism in this truism. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Who'd have guessed it? According to BC's Auditor General, our provincial leaders have been fudging figures on costs for their 2010 Olympic party. He refuses to release a required audit until the BC government comes clean with the real numbers. He's the third Auditor General to request the Campbell provide a clear accounting of all expenses that will be paid by BC's taxpayers. The announced $600 million price tag is crafted in such a way as to exclude some of the cost from public scrutiny. Campbell's is, as promised, the most open and transparent government in Canada. Of course, we have to rely on his definition of open and transparent, which may be different from common expectations. Both the United States and Canada report a decline in driving deaths when the price of gasoline rose drastically. Experts are attributing this to a reduction in the use of vehicles as well as slower driving. Accepting this at face value, why haven't Campbell's Liberals promoted their carbon tax on fuels as life-saving rather than just environmentally responsible? When prices fall, as they have been doing recently, government could step up their take, cutting fatalities while bringing in money that would pay to ameliorate the effects of recession on citizens. Just a thought. Vancouver Olympic Committee is whistling past the graveyard. They claim not to be worried by the financial crisis of two of their major sponsors, Nortel and General Motors. Although Nortel is on the brink of insolvency, Vanek says that most of their pledged aid was in kind and most has been delivered. GM's is a bit more problematic, as they have promised $70 million in cash and cars. Will there even be a GM in 2010? How many other pledges will be reneged as times grow tougher? Then there's the collapse of that Whistler gondola tower. This will not instill public confidence in the administration of that venue. Recall that Whistler Blackcomb was the target of a leveraged buyout that recently came within hours of failing to refinance a multi-billion dollar debt for that purchase. They're struggling to cover payments on that debt, and perhaps, just perhaps, they might have skimped on maintenance to help their cash flow. The Athletes' Village in Vancouver. The company which is building it has been granted $100 million in emergency funding by the city. Some village. If it comes in on time and on budget, its 1,100 units will cost close to a cool $1 million each, excluding cost of the land. The Mounties are trying yet again to charter cruise ships to house 5,000 federal cops to be added to the other security types. We don't know who'll pay for that bit of luxury accommodation. The budget set for the security was $175 million, but threatens to exceed $1 billion. Vanek is walking through a minefield in these turbulent times and trying to prevent panic among suppliers, ticket holders, and governments, which will have to pick up the tab for all overruns. While most of us are leery of getting involved with a new product of the former Big Three, one loyal customer has faith. You may have seen him driving that oversized GMC pickup with a decal on the rear window, you know, the one showing the cartoon kid peeing on a Ford logo. His daddy always drove GM products when they were running, and now has one of those hermaphrodite Cadillacs that's neither car nor truck. He calculates fuel economy in liters per kilometer, but he loves to run it when he can afford a fill. This guy knows that GM will be with us forever and is showing his entrepreneurial acumen by bidding on an Oldsmobile dealership. His battle cry is, "The Olds shall rise again." Send him your Canadian Confederate money. He collects that, too. Hooray for Danny Williams appropriating the timber and water rights from Abitibi Bowater. This company was granted access to these provincial assets in exchange for providing jobs for Newfoundlanders. The premier has declared that when the company no longer hires those people, it sacrifices the rights granted. Abitibi claims that it has the right to sell the provincial timber and water to another corporation as it closes its paper mill. I hope that Williams is able to beat off legal challenges, not least of which will be launched under the terms of the NAFTA. While Abitibi liked to posture as a Canadian outfit, it now declares that it's chartered in the state of Delaware and can sue as an American. Very interesting. Gordon Campbell says he would never stand up for British Columbians as Williams did for Newfoundland. Once the BC gives away rights to public land and resources, regardless of the terms, they're gone forever into the maw of corporate ownership. Half a century ago, the Aluminum Company of Canada was allowed to dam the northern Nechaco River, reversing its natural flow, diverting it to a reservoir and sending it through a hydroelectric power station. The agreement stated that hydropower was to be used to make aluminum and to develop industry, quote, in the vicinity of the works. British Columbia gave up our river for a promise to bring this remote area of BC into the world economy. It was a swap of power for jobs. Alcan is no longer a Canadian company, having been purchased by Rio Tinto. The new owner decided there isn't enough profit in running the aging smelter, and they won't replace it. They can make more money by selling electric power produced at a ridiculously low cost from our river to our BC Hydro at a huge profit. Campbell's liberal regime sees nothing wrong with this. The Nechaco River is now private property, and Rio Tinto Alcan may do whatever it pleases with the power it provides, especially if it helps undermine the reach of BC Hydro preparatory to its privatization. Just imagine a BC provincial government with the cojones shown by Newfoundland's. Picture a premier who would stand up to the corporate monster, telling him that reneging on the agreement to use our river for its intended purpose means that it loses the right to harness its power. Such a premier might even expropriate the dam with proper compensation if Alcan refused to use it to make aluminum. But this is a dream. Gordon Campbell represents the interests of corporations, domestic and foreign, in their exploitation of public resources with minimal control. Go ahead, do as you wish with our timber, our waters, our natural resources. As the man says, British Columbia is open for business, one of the planet's largest garage sales. If I disliked George Bush, I hated Richard Nixon. If possible, that man was more despicable. Hunter Thompson said on Richard Nixon's death in 1994, "If the right people had been in charge of Nixon's funeral, his casket would have been launched into one of those open sewage canals that empty into the ocean just south of Los Angeles. He was a swine of a man and a jabbering dupe of a president. Nixon was so crooked, he needed servants to help him screw his pants on every morning." Nixon and his creepy predecessor Lyndon Johnson were responsible for the slaughter of untold Southeast Asians in a cause that was as phony as Bush's weapons of mass destruction. For the Johnson-Nixon regimes, the excuse for indiscriminate murder was a domino theory, claiming that allowing Vietnam independence would lead irrevocably to all of Asia converting to communism. Total bullshit, but it sold to a somnolent American public. Then there was the invasion of Cambodia, billed not as an invasion, but as a limited-duration protective reaction strike by Nixon. Oh yes, this was supposedly an attempt to disrupt a command and control center of the Vietnamese resistance. The invaders found nothing of the sort, but they sure killed a lot of Cambodians. Then they went on to initiate the secret war, secret from the American public, but not so from the peasants under the falling ordnance. Between 1964 and 1973, Laos was the recipient of the equivalent of one B-52 load of bombs every 8 minutes. There was so much steel dropped there that recovery of bomb scrap is a major industry for peasantry, which is not able to grow enough to feed themselves on their devastated land these days. Much of this ordnance was in the form of cluster bombs. The unexploded bomblets left behind are estimated to run to 80 million of the quarter billion dropped. Over the years, at least 13,000 Laotians have been killed or maimed by this residue of war, many of them being boys attempting to salvage scrap steel. Cluster bombs are one of the more disgusting developments of modern warfare, designed to ruin a land, leaving it unusable, rather like the Romans salting the farms of Carthage, but more lethal. Those foolish or desperate enough to cultivate this Laotian land live on the edge every moment and die on droves. Cluster bombs are now banned by an international convention signed by over 100 governments, yet 75 nations still stockpile these lethal toys. Of course, the usual suspects, the United States, China, Russia, India, Pakistan, and Israel, have refused to sign. They maintain they have the sovereign right to strew these bomblets upon future enemies at will. Welcome to the 21st century, when we're supposed to be civilized. But few Canadians are worried much about death and dismemberment in faraway places, not when they're about to celebrate the birth of the Prince of Peace by exchanging the detritus of Chinese sweatshops. We're more concerned with the value of our savings and homes, our pensions and credit cards. We drop a quarter in the Salvation Army bucket and think ourselves generous. After all, isn't that coin more than a fourth of what a Laotian peasant would earn in a day? What more do these unemployed bums want anyway? A more important aspect of our lives is what's on television. We were shocked to find that current economic difficulties have hit the networks, and that wonderful program, Canadian Idol, will be cut this coming year. Oh, woe is us. As for me, I wonder why this would be cut when there are more Canadians idle these days than have been for years. Go figure. An old friend sent me this slight alteration of a poem with which we are all familiar. I must share with you this version called A Visit from St. Nick. 'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even my spouse. The socks were all flung o'er the back of a chair. She was happily snoring with never a care. It always is so, she must have a snooze just after imbibing three tumblers of booze. Then out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I ran to the door to see what was the matter. And what to my poor bloodshot eyes did appear but St. Nick in a sleigh with eight cranky reindeer. And then in a twinkle I heard each cloven hoof just tramping and pawing, destroying my roof. Nick came down the chimney with his famous bound and scattered the ashes and soot all around. He spoke not a word but went straight to his work, filled socks with deer droppings and snowballs, the jerk. He laughed with like a banshee, and thumbing his nose, with the help from my boot, up the chimney he rose, fell into his sleigh, gave his team a loud yell, then away they all flew like a bat out of hell. And I heard him complain as he drove out of sight, "Wish I had a soft cushion to sit on this night." Merry Christmas to all. I hope you're having a pleasant holiday season with family and friends, away from the madding crowd and all that damned commercialism. This has been your Uncle Don with show number 295, my penultimate show for 2008. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Onward and upward, pilgrims.